Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast. It's a Black Friday edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up, we'll not only talk about Black Friday and, of course, Thanksgiving shopping traffic, but also successful earnings for Lowe's after Home Depot announced successful earnings last week. And we'll talk about more strength in the dollar store sector with Dollar Tree. But first this, you know about the perks that come with owning your own business, like financial freedom, being your own boss, and having more control of your time. But maybe you're just not sure where to start. All of this could potentially be yours if you open a UPS store franchise.
They come with 35 years of franchising support there, and they were just ranked the number four top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. The UPS store offers stability, the support and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and a proven business model with all the training and marketing support you'll need to make your entrepreneurial dreams come true. Stores are available in large and small markets across the country, and their experts will help find a location that's just right for you.
Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner could be now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. Well, we begin our show usually with an earnings call or two or some news and notes from around the world of retail, but instead, we're going to go completely subjective and completely anecdotal kind of for this first story as we talk about Black Friday and Thanksgiving shopping. We're waiting to record this episode, of course, until Friday, until Black Friday had kicked off. So Leighton and I are giving you basically fresh analysis, but only analysis through our sets of eyeballs, more or less. We should remember for our listeners, as the NRF noted, sales during Thanksgiving weekend more spread out than they once were. In fact, the number of shoppers planning to shop on Saturday and Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend up considerably, and you're seeing that shopping be more spread out from the span of Wednesday prior to Thanksgiving all the way through Cyber Monday. So despite the fact that a large number of people are planning to shop still on Black Friday, there are a large portion of people that are going to shop in one of those other days. With that in mind, expect Black Friday numbers, neutral or negative from last year, just for that day, especially with an increasing number of businesses doing Thanksgiving Day sales. There will no doubt be a lot of clickbait headlines trumpeting Black Friday declines next week and the death of brick and mortar, but we should remember that the grand majority of brick and mortar retail businesses have even or positive same-store sales in the last quarter, and Thanksgiving weekend sales overall should be up slightly over last year, perhaps as much as 4%, though we think Thanksgiving weekend sales probably be up around 2-3% over last year. So we start out our coverage with Black Friday and the Thanksgiving Day shopping with Leighton. And I know, Leighton, you've had some observations of yourself, but first of all, I think you're going to give us some real, actual numbers that the NRF has produced.
Yeah, you started off the story by saying it's going to be anecdotal and our personal projections for the retail season, the retail holiday as a whole during the Black Friday events. But I think, you know, if you take a big view, it's going to be very healthy, a lot of positive news, especially in retail stocks. We've been looking at price to earnings ratios. They've been going up as the overall market's been going up, but a lot of positive consumer sentiment out there for a number of reasons. A number of reasons that actually Lowe's, a company we're going to talk about a little bit later in their earnings report, talked about on the macro level, talking about better wages, fuller employment. And so I think if you translate this to the Black Friday weekend, the five really big days of retail sales, you can see that it's probably going to come out with very good news in the next couple of weeks as the numbers start to tick in, retailers give their perspective on the amount of foot traffic that they see. But an estimated 69% of Americans are projected to participate. So if you're actually comparing that to other years, that's similar, but actually a little bit higher. And this is according to the NRF. Sales figures are going to be a function of having more people purchase things, but also average ticket may be a little bit lower too, because it's going to be more diversified in nature. And by that, we mean it's going to be spread out across multiple retailers. It's not just going to be Walmart or Target. You remember years ago, before e-commerce really picked up with double-digit comps every year, you saw that people would just pick one or two retailers on Black Friday to go out and get those best deals, because by the time they could get through those long shopping lines, everybody else was pretty much sold out of those hot items. 164 million people are projected to be involved in this weekend's holiday sales. This includes Thanksgiving, like Trent had mentioned, Black Friday, Cyber Monday sales as well. And this is really a typical S-curve. If you look at the trend analysis from 2015 and 2016, it really starts to pick up Wednesday. You see the peak of sales happening Friday. It starts to slow down Saturday and Sunday, but then pick back up to above Saturday's levels on Cyber Monday. This is on top of the NRF's 2016 projected figures, where 154 million people partook in these different retailing activities, up from 151 million people in 2015. You can see that the trend is probably going to come out with these 164 million people that are projected to come out and either bear the weather or shop online. The big question is whether or not e-commerce sales is still going to continue with strong double-digit comps year over year, like I had mentioned. I think that's going to be something that a lot of analysts are looking towards to really have those clickbait headlines, as Trent alluded to, saying that brick and mortar is dead. But anecdotally, the retailers I've visited thus far, they seem really well prepared. Traffic levels, at least, again, from my perspective, seem about average for the season. But something that is really interesting to me and a fascinating dynamic from the operations side is the fact that they've really boosted employment. So there's a lot more employees that are facing the shelves, preparing the stores for the massive influx of people. One example that I'm going to give is from a Kroger subsidiary. They're actually seeing a lot more employees. And I asked some of the employees, is this more than last year? And they said, yes, management wants to be well prepared in order to be able to serve the needs for those customers coming in on Friday. I think that's a very smart decision because, yes, you're paying more employees time and a half, let's say. Those holiday pay figures are going to come up a little bit. But overall, I think it's better to be well prepared, even though, let's say, the grocery sector is not going to be taking the biggest chunk of the retail sales. I think overall, if you look at the survey data, again, extrapolating from the NRF's most recent survey, you're seeing that 66% said they're actually going to be participating in these holiday sales during Black Friday and beyond because of that promotional pricing. What's interesting is that number is not higher. You would think that nearly 100% of those participating in all of these activities surrounding retailing would be trying to take advantage of all the promotional pricing that you see in either banner ads or those flyers that are being handed out. The remainder said that they needed to actually do the holiday shopping regardless. This was very interesting for me because unless you're trying to take advantage of specific pricing, let's say on big ticket electronic items, what have you, why would you be going through the nightmare of all the traffic, not only the in-store traffic, but the traffic to get to some of these retailers in the bigger metropolitan areas? The last thing I wanted to mention is that weather is going to be a big factor. And a factor that really hasn't been mentioned up to this point by other websites that surround the retail industry. You see that weather this month has actually been rather mild in the Midwest, South, and Western areas of the United States. And this is going to be playing a role. It's sort of the dynamic with the total sales. Total sales could be higher. The sales could be very good year over year, but also where the transactions occur. Brick and mortar can obviously benefit from having better weather versus last year. And so you could actually see digital sales not come up to the point that a lot of analysts think they could. The retailers I've visited, again, have seemed like they've had some neutral traffic levels over last year. But I am curious, once those big sales hit on Friday, how that's going to fare.
And I'll come in with some of the more anecdotal notes. Obviously, Layton talked to one of the Kroger subsidiaries that he was mentioning. I went through traffic on Thanksgiving and also early on Black Friday, and I'm actually in the same location this year as I was for last year's Thanksgiving, which has been a little bit rare. So I made it a goal this year to make it to some of the same places hour after hour that I made last year. Traffic on Thanksgiving afternoon and evening, just by eyeballing, appeared to be up over last year, especially given the number of spaces taken up in parking spots, especially the number of people waiting in lines. You're looking at JCPenney and Walmart as catalysts for these particular locations, but I did drive by a Sears location that had probably three people, four if you count an infant child waiting in line at one entrance and about a dozen waiting in line at another entrance. So that's not good for Sears. And by the way, that was 20 minutes before they were slated to open on Thanksgiving evening at 6 p.m. Meanwhile, Black Friday traffic just appears to be a little bit more slim. And in this particular area where I'm at, talking to retail employees last year, they mentioned Black Friday traffic was down last year as well, in part because of the Thanksgiving Day sales. I think one interesting dynamic to watch going forward is the grocery sales ahead of Thanksgiving. Leighton did a great job talking about some of the gift-giving sales, some of the deals going on with electronics and all of that. But I'm really anxious to see where grocery sales come in ahead of Thanksgiving. I talked to a store manager at a Trader Joe's on Wednesday prior to Thanksgiving. They mentioned it was the first time in 8 years that they still had turkeys on that Wednesday prior to Thanksgiving. The question is, of course, supply versus demand. He said they had anticipated robust demand, stocked more turkeys this year than in years past, and also mentioned he expected to sell out before close on that Wednesday. Whole Foods is a different story, though. Despite all the talk about prime deals for turkeys at Whole Foods Market, and by prime deals, I mean deals for Amazon Prime consumers where they're able to purchase the turkey at a cheaper price per pound. The location I visited on Thanksgiving had at least 100 turkeys left just 1 hour before close. Now, some of these were still reserved for those who had ordered full meals or full meal prep kits from Whole Foods, but of course there were a lot that weren't, and especially since it was just an hour before close at this location, time was running out for those who had pre-ordered the full meals. Now, this same location was nearly sold out. Just a few young birds left last year at the same time, 1 hour before close, and I asked a few employees if they were busier than last year. Some of them said, yeah, some of them said, not really, and I think the not really's probably had the majority of it overall. And it's interesting that despite all the talk of discounts, the turkeys at the Whole Foods I went to didn't move at a quicker pace this year over last, though the store did get slightly more in stock, I was led to believe, this year over last. Finally, the Kroger affiliate I visited was absolutely packed, more so than the same time on the Wednesday evening than last year. Their displays at the Kroger affiliate seemed to be a little bit more cohesive than Whole Foods Market as well. And one thing that I thought was odd for Whole Foods, Thanksgiving Day, they had three massive displays devoted to nothing other than mandarin oranges. Now, they did have a fairly large sweet potato display, but outside of that, a lot of the Thanksgiving staples were kind of out of sight, out of mind, and they weren't in those premier spaces right when you walk into the Whole Foods. So I thought that was very interesting, whereas Kroger went all in on everything you need to make a pumpkin pie. They had displays for other things as well. Kroger went all in with every step of the Thanksgiving staples, and I think they're not busy necessarily because of that, but we talk about that phenomenon of trying to sell one more item and get one more item in the cart, and I'll be anxious to see if Kroger doesn't see same-store sales pop across the country simply because their planogram seemed to be absolutely on point this year, even more so than last.
Well, a week after Home Depot's earnings crush it, Lowe's comes through with similar successes that we thought may happen and play a factor in the overall home improvement space. This has been a big quarter for that home improvement space in general, with a couple of macro factors in play. First, as we mentioned before, there's a lot of positive momentum in the sector due to larger amounts of discretionary income and the general home ownership rates. Second, as we discussed last week, the hurricanes have produced positive top-line results as residents attempt to rebuild or repair some of their homes. And if you look, this report from Lowe's reflects sales from the third quarter and was released on Tuesday, November 21st. A lot of positive things to draw in from this earnings release. You see the numbers. Top line revenue saw a 6.5% boost. Home Depot's was a little bit over 7%. This was from $15.7 billion in sales last year to $16.8 billion this year. Three things contributed to this particular bump. Hurricanes, which added $200 million to the top line. We put this another way, they accounted for 22% of the revenue increase that they saw this year. New locations, this was a very slight impact, only three new locations in this quarter and 25 since the year end. The company now has 2,144 stores from the 2,119 they had last year. And same store sales increased a little bit, and this was aside from hurricane impacts. Those same store sales were up 5.7% company-wide. 5.1% in the United States, and even larger growth in Mexico and Canada, something again that Home Depot had talked about. And this was something that was even a focal point throughout the earnings transcript from management. This is a sequential increase also driven largely by the hurricane boost, excluding hurricanes. Using our own math based on the publicly available figures, we see that their same-store sales would have been around 3.3% if not for that extra $200 million in sales, a 4.8% increase in comp average ticket, and transaction growth of around 0.9%. And you see that 0.9% really not a figure they should be too proud of, but as long as it's positive, they are headed in the right direction. Again, a lot more people visit newer stores, and that could play a part in the overall dynamic as well, since they only had three openings during the quarter. As with Home Depot, the increase in sales came at the cost of a slight decrease in margins. Gross margin as a percent of sales was down from 34.4% to 34.1%. However, what was interesting is despite these gross margin figures, management did cite inflation on some of the goods they sold that were related to that hurricane boost. Net income was a slight beat on analyst expectations, with expectations at $1.02 per share, and the number coming in at around $1.05. Although they mentioned that this is up from 43 cents last year, their adjusted number last year was 88 cents, so this is more of a slight bump when you exclude one-time expenses. Most of these one-time expenses were a result of the wind down of Hydrox in Australia. The increase in operating income as a percentage of net revenues, this was 9.23% from around 6% last year, was largely a result of one-time expenses not showing up on the ledger in this third quarter. In addition to Hydrox, Lowe's also cited strategic initiatives from last year's third quarter.
Let's look at some of the takeaways from the transcript and being on the earnings call. We mentioned at the top of the story they had successes very similar to Home Depot, and that was mostly right. Home Depot had positive comps in all regions of the United States. So did Lowe's in this quarter. Right away, management noted green comps in all of their regions, but also, and this differs from Home Depot, all of their product categories. Home Depot did have a few negative figures across some of their categories. Largely, though, they were positive. In this case, Lowe's cited positive boosts across all categories. Home Depot, though, in specific, mentioned boosts in particular among bigger ticket items. No such boost mentioned here in the Lowe's call. Lowe's had an influx of sales in building supplies. This was related to increases in contractor buys, or what they call their pro division. Double-digit comps from hurricane prep, which is something that we haven't highlighted, people getting ready for the hurricanes to hit in the third quarter, and of course the aftermath and cleanup-related sales as well. Items were most likely priced higher here also, generally, not speaking about the hurricane items, but overall, items were priced a little bit higher due to inflation. Year over year, at least, their CEO noted inflation during the call. They mentioned that plumbing and electric were strengths. Omnichannel had momentum as well, and Layton will talk in a second about his omnichannel transaction recently through Lowe's. In fact, they thanked omnichannel integration for a 33% bump in digital sales. They mentioned that feedback has been positive from the constant evolution of all of their platforms. In our opinion, you know, their mobile site, not the app, but their mobile site is slightly better in terms of being user-friendly and having that search optionality readily available over Home Depot's same mobile site. In fact, they're among Lowe's, Forbes magazine's top 10 consumer-engaged businesses, which obviously helps when you've got a mobile platform that works well. And the key is that search optionality, because oftentimes when you're looking, especially for a large appliance, you want to direct your search in a very specific area. Now, we had talked in prior quarters about their acquisitions of Maintenance Supply Headquarters and also Central Wholesalers. These acquisitions remain on track. They spoke during the earnings call of how these will help support the multifamily housing industry, which is something that Layton and I have both talked about is on the grow overall in the U.S. This is an industry that's seen a huge boost in supply from new builds. Longer term, of course, This means having to maintain units, which would build into the Lowe's brick and mortar footprint as well. So everything kind of working together here, not necessarily synergistic as far as that goes, but certainly these two businesses scratch each other's backs. Maintenance Supply Headquarters distributes products designed to maintain, but also renovate the multifamily buildings, such as appliances, plumbing, HVAC, and lighting. This company is based in Houston, was acquired in May for $512 million. Central Wholesalers was bought in 2016, so they've had a little bit longer of a chance to get Central Wholesalers into the fold. And like with Home Depot, Lowe's cited strengths in Mexico and Canada. This despite the fact that they've exited some of their other international operations. Leighton mentioned the Hydrox business being exited in Australia, but Lowe's overall sees a continued trend with all of North America. Leighton's going to talk about this trend and some of these trends, but first he's going to talk about his recent omnichannel experience with the home improvement retailer.
We're kind of all over the place, so we have to apologize to our listeners here. But Lowe's, it's a very interesting story because I've been a longtime customer. I just so happen to live a little bit closer to a Lowe's than a Home Depot. So I go to the Lowe's a little bit more often, even if Home Depot beats on price. But here recently, I had to buy a new washer, a front-loading washer, so I had to do some research ahead of time, and I called some local suppliers to see what brands were a little bit more convenient, a little bit more reliable long-term than others. And to be honest with you, because I knew I was probably going to be going to Lowe's, I didn't really do a lot of price comparisons, but I did have to use the mobile search mechanism. And Trent talked about that search optionality, and that's extremely important because once I had honed in on a particular brand, I then had to get a price point. But for me, I was actually already given a promotional email by Lowe's, and I had seen that a Samsung washer was on sale. And so I went in store to actually buy it. One would ask, why did I actually go in store when I could buy it online, the same price, same free shipping? However, I wanted to schedule delivery. Delivery is free after a certain price point for Lowe's and Home Depot. And so I decided to buy it in store because it would be a little bit easier to see all the appointments, get it lined up, and see that they actually have me in their setup calendar. So otherwise, I would have had to schedule over the phone, and I like the ability to see everything in person and get that experience. And so I'm a little bit different in that sort of way, and that I use their omnichannel platform, if you will, to actually search through to the different products, look at the different ratings, compare the different brands, and then make my purchase in store. And to be honest with you, it was a fairly good experience. But another recent example, if you were to compare these two major home improvement retailers, I was actually needing to make maybe just a dozen smaller ticket item purchases at my local Lowe's. And I found that Home Depot, when having to make these same or similar purchases, they actually came through with a little bit better price point. They had a little bit better customer service. So if you're comparing the two retailers here, the two biggest retailers in the US in this space, I would say that Home Depot does have an advantage in terms of brick and mortar. Again, this is only anecdotal. I don't work for either of these companies, but Lowe's certainly has it down in terms of their mobile and mobile search. So I think the companies are both very good at what they do. But in my personal experience, Home Depot staff was a little bit more helpful. And like I said, the price point and the variety of items they have in particular categories and particular category niches were a little bit better in store at Home Depot. Overall, you see that Home Depot is trying to take advantage of customers like myself in the home improvement sector by trying to capitalize on a number of factors. And they take a more macroeconomic view of the US as a whole and really apply that to their own business. By that, I mean they're looking at wage growth, employment, and more lines of consumer credit, all as contributing factors in the next few years. And what is interesting about their business is that even if millennials like the apartment living a little bit more than owning a home per se, that is still money in their pocket via the acquisitions that Trent talked about. But also, if you think about it, tenant turnover, you have to repaint the apartments, you have to go through everything, maybe you have to change a couple light fixtures. So all of these multifamily rehabs are also going to be contributing to the company down the line. And as for those areas of the country seeing some gentrification, I know Trent's in Colorado right now, some areas in Denver and Colorado Springs are experiencing this with 100-year-old houses being fully renovated. The single family home areas, this is going to be another opportunity for those who actually do want to live in a home and raise their family. So I think millennials are going to be doing both, but to be honest with you, it's still going to be a win for places like Lowe's and Home Depot. They still see housing demand outpacing supply, which is so far true if you look at the data. Multifamily is said to be catching up, though, in terms of demand, in terms of supply meeting demand, as cap rates are said to be bottoming out. You see that Lowe's, for their part, has always tried to promote their credit card, which offers 5% off at the register, similar to what, say, a Target does. And Lowe's and Home Depot both offer seasonal credit card pushes, sales pushes at least, giving their customers a certain amount off their first transaction, say between $15 and $40 off, depending on the total basket size if it meets a certain threshold. What is more interesting is that Lowe's has been surveying customers a little bit more to extract macro-based results. And if we look at a statement from the company's press release, we see that it says, "We survey consumers. We continue to see favorable trends. Our third quarter consumer sentiment survey highlighted that consumers have increasingly positive view of the national economy and continue to view their personal financial situation favorably." So these are survey questions that aren't asking, when are you doing your next home remodel? Were you satisfied with the Lowe's experience? These are more macroeconomic questions that, again, really highlights the positive effects of the current macro situation. So we talk about full employment, more discretionary income. That discretionary income may lead to a bathroom remodel you really didn't need until maybe 5-10 years down the line. The last little bit of this story is actually going to be talking about their new COO. This was in conjunction with their press release from the third quarter earnings. From their investor relations page, you can see that Richard D. Maltzbarger, the Lowe's Chief Development Officer and President of the International Division, has been appointed the official Chief Operating Officer effective February 3rd. If you go through Richard's history, he's actually been with Lowe's since 2004, so he knows the company in and out. And he actually started in the consumer analytics side of things, which actually does play into operations if you think about it, relating to the supply chain optimization. You look at his most recent experience, he has a lot of senior leadership roles, including business development, senior vice president of strategy, vice president of strategic planning, and vice president of research. So you see that his education background and his background within Lowe's corporate is going to be really integral in playing an important part of the COO position. Overall trend, it looked as though the executive changes and the positive earnings highlights contributed to an already healthy stock price.
Yeah, and keep in mind that Lowe's shares tend to pop when Home Depot has a solid earnings call because they're tethered together, and Lowe's usually reports earnings exactly a week after Home Depot. So shares stayed virtually unchanged Tuesday after the press release and formal COO appointment. They were around $81 per share immediately before and after results. Now they floated around $79 at the close of trading on Wednesday. All-time highs this year, over $86 back in May, around the time of the maintenance supply headquarters acquisition. They're up 9.5% for the trailing 52 weeks with a price-to-earnings ratio fairly respectable of 19. It's slightly growth-centric, not as much as Home Depot, who has a price-to-earnings ratio of around 23 and a $66 billion market cap versus Home Depot's $202 billion market cap. We mentioned it at the top of the show, but you know about the perks that come with owning your own business. There are so many of them, including being your own boss, having more control of your time. Financial freedom's great too. But I understand a lot of our listeners that don't own their own business may not be sure where to start. Well, a potential great place to start would be seeking out what it would take to open a UPS Store franchise.
The UPS Store does have 35 years of franchising experience to give you the peace of mind when opening or starting a new business. They offer stability, the support and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and a proven business model with all the training and marketing support you'll need to feel comfortable. And to be honest with you, if you look at the landscape, a lot of white space out there. And stores right now are available in small and large markets across the country, and their experts will help you find a location that's just right.
Plus, there's financing for those who qualify, special programs for military veterans as well. The time to promote yourself to business owner is now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. no interview on this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast. Don't want to tie up anyone during this very important retail week, but we'll be back with Brett Bernstein of Gatsby next week discussing the dynamics between micro-influencers and retail. We'll talk about what all that means next week. This week, though, to close out the news portion of our show, we turn our attention to the dollar store segment as Dollar Tree shows signs of continued strength in the sector with a beat on earnings Tuesday. The earnings call was for their third quarter. Analysts expected earnings of 90 cents per share, and the company blitzed past those expectations by 12% with earnings of $1.01 per share. As a result, stock popped the Wednesday after the call to a 52-week high for the retailer, and there aren't too many retailers who can say that in this last year, given the swirl of market negativity surrounding the sector of late. So Dollar Tree, one of those rare stocks that the market seems to like right now with these positive earnings calls. And Leighton, as we go over the earnings numbers, basically every single number they have got better year over year.
This is a company I'm a little sour about, if I'm going to be honest here, because this is a company I looked at earlier this year. The stock was around $64, $65 a share. It had cratered, and I noticed that there's actually going to be a lot of upside opportunity here. I was not actually looking at this amount of upside. So for one, I'm happy for Dollar Tree, but for two, I'm a little disappointed that I did not get in the share price, if not a long-term trade, at least potentially for a short-term swing. I know a lot of analysts at the time, Jim Cramer was even saying that $65, $70, that range for this particular dollar store was actually overpriced still. So now we see all-time highs for the company. Very positive news. And as you said, Trent, basically every number got better. Net sales up 6.3% from $5 billion to $5.32 billion this year. Same store sales were up 3.2%, a very healthy number in this particular sector. Although they did note that excluding Canadian currency impacts, it was 3.3%, up 5% at Dollar Tree, 1.5% at Family Dollar. And this is something we've seen time and time again. Ever since the company acquired Family Dollar, it seems to be operating its own stores, its own legacy concept a little bit better. And that only makes sense considering there must have been some executive consolidations from Family Dollar. Those actually we had talked about to some degree, but you see that talking about the operator's gross margin, it increased from 30.4% to 31.3% this quarter. This is usually a result of lower merchandise costs, and this was exactly the case here. Not only did merchandise costs decrease, but occupancy costs did as well as an overall percentage of sales. You'll see occupancy costs decrease as a percentage of sales when the same store sales increases outpace rent inflation across stores open 1 year. This is a retailer that is very interesting from the commercial real estate side, Trent, because if you look at its portfolio of stores, they're not really opposed to getting into some different areas of the country in order to sell their merchandise. But with that comes cheaper rents. So you're seeing a lot of double net rents as opposed to triple net rents. For Dollar Tree, one store in particular that I live by, the building's actually for sale, and if you look at some of the information that's publicly available, you can see that it does have a double net setup. So they're not responsible for the structure like you would see for a potential Five Below store that's looking to be in a nicer area demographically. Sales and general administrative expenses were down as a percentage of revenue as well. Another positive here, from 23.6% of sales last year to around 23.3% of sales, lower depreciation costs, lower healthcare costs, and lower utility costs, all playing a part in that figure. Healthcare is interesting. We always talk about the economies of scale when it comes to merchandise, but companies often reap cost savings as the number of employees enrolled in benefit programs go up as well. However, the lowered costs were offset by higher hourly payroll, that wage inflation we've been talking about, higher advertising costs, and higher legal fees. But overall, you see that the retailer is keeping everything in check, if not more in check than what those analysts were expecting this quarter. Finally, diluted earnings per share or net income was up to $1.01 this year versus 72 cents last year and over analyst expectations of 90 cents, as we mentioned. This is on a GAAP basis as well, reflective of a 40.3% increase year over year. And Trent, if you go through some of the call takeaways here, management is very clear on one thing: Dollar Tree is crushing it, and they talked about their same-store sales hitting a 5% increase over the same quarter last year. A lot of positives to glean from the Dollar Tree concept.
That's right, and we should remind listeners, of course, that Dollar Tree is comprised of both Family Dollar and Dollar Tree. And when we mean Dollar Tree is crushing it, we mean the specific stores rather than the overall company, which is also crushing it. It's just the stores themselves for Dollar Tree that are doing so much better. You mentioned 5% same-store sales increases on the comp line. Last year's third quarter was pretty good for Dollar Tree as well, so it's not like they're going against a weak quarter for comps. Their gross profit at Dollar Tree is now above 35.1% to be exact. It's the first time that's happened in a long while, and operating income for just Dollar Tree, excluding Family Dollar, was a whopping 11.8% of sales in this third quarter. That matches numbers from the first two quarters combined. We talked about Lowe's having operating income as a percentage of sales in the 9% range. For perspective, Home Depot, a company we rave about from a margin standpoint, had operating income at 14.7% as a percentage of sales last quarter. For a dollar store, though, to be pulling in as a percentage of sales, 11.8% of sales as operating income is astounding. Also, the company as a whole, including both Dollar Tree and Family Dollar, is continuing to open stores at a brisk pace, much like their main rival, Dollar General. 163 net store openings in the third quarter. That's representative of 169 openings and 6 closings. They also expanded or relocated 23 stores. As we've discussed in the past, they're attempting to update many of their older Dollar Trees and some Family Dollars to include more perishable and frozen goods offerings. The good news for the company is that the batch of closures associated with the acquisition of Family Dollar in 2015 seems to be about done. This will produce more cost savings on the GAAP bottom line, and it likely already did this quarter as well. Now, looking ahead, they see a 3.7% growth in square footage in the fourth quarter as a combined result of store openings and store expansions. They also see low single-digit same-store sales increases. Diluted earnings per share also falling in the $1.80 to $1.89 range. As mentioned, the positivity surrounding this earnings call and the excellence in their numbers produced quite a pop on the market before it closed for Thanksgiving. It was up about 3% from where it began on Tuesday, and Wednesday got as high as $100.74. That's a 52-week high. It leveled off at $99.78. It closed Wednesday. It began the year around $77. It was around $90 last year at this time. They saw lows in the mid-60s, as Leighton mentioned on the outset of this story, during the course of the last 52 weeks. A growth-centric price-to-earnings ratio, we feel like, for good reason, of 25.5. So the stock market feels like there's room to grow. We agree. We feel like there's a lot of white space still to be filled up in the country for Dollar Tree, and also room to grow their same store sales as well, and a $23.63 billion market cap overall for the company.
You mentioned white space, Trent. Dollarama, just a little bit off topic here, but Dollarama, Canada's largest dollar store, is actually booming right now. And this is interesting because this is a segment of the population that does not have as many dollar stores per capita. And so you see a lot of white space in the U.S. You can only imagine what that means for those particular Canadian markets, particularly the more populated segments of that population. We look in our last story at DSW, or Designer Shoe Warehouse. They've hurt a little bit after hurricanes and falling sales attributed to these hurricanes. We see the prominent shoe retailer is known for getting in newer areas of commercial development. The company, however, most recently posted earnings on Tuesday of this week, and shares declined double digits as outlook was significantly weakened again because of those hurricanes, as we mentioned. But we're going to be getting into those details, or moreover, Trent's going to be getting into those specific details and to see some interesting facts there. But on a GAAP basis, the shoe retailer reported net income for the third quarter at just $4 million or 5 cents per share. This is really low. This is a very low number. However, if you look at the adjusted mark of 45 cents per share, that was still below adjusted expectations of 53 cents. The main story here is how they will be affected long term, though. How these misses now affect the full year figures. That's what a lot of media headlines were trying to cover. Full year earnings per share is now slated to be between $1.40 and $1.45 per share. This was around 10 cents off on the higher side. So the top end of the earnings per share was slated to be around $1.55. You can see that they missed analyst expectations on that front, missed company expectations as well. Gross profit decreased 120 basis points due to increased shipping expenses. Operating expenses included some line items that are going to be beneficial for the company long term and a little bit detrimental too if you look at the company's current strategy. I'll get into those details as we see that technology improvements and enhanced marketing efforts were made in order to capture or recapture industry market share. They said that the market share is going to be a struggle for them going forward, which isn't a good thing you want to hear from a company that should be growing. And that stock price is indicative of a growth company. They are a company that does, however, not do too much historically with conventional media. However, it may be time for the company to change that. Therefore, the selling, general, and administrative expenses may be changing in terms of the dynamic and total cost structure long term. It's something that you're going to be a little bit wary of heading into the holidays. Top line revenue did increase, however, a modest increase of 1.7% to $708.3 million. This was a miss, but a very slight miss in terms of expectations. Analysts were expecting $709.6 million in that top line. Comp store sales actually weren't that bad, coming in at negative 0.4% for the third quarter. They could always be worse. This is actually ahead of where DSW was in for the first 6 months of the year. Comps for the first 9 months now sit at negative 1%. So you can see that they're actually technically improving sequentially when looking at the back half of the year. Comp sales were positive in the second quarter. It was mostly the first quarter that dragged them down here. This is also why we say hurricanes are a convenient scapegoat for some businesses. DSW same-store sales were likely to be negative anyway, and it does appear that the hurricanes had very little impact based on the information we have from them over the past 2 years or so. But Trent, a lot of other factors to blame here. I noted hurricanes, but the company operationally is changing some things up that may benefit the financials long-term.
Let's first get to some of the other factors to blame. They mentioned very briefly in their earnings release that cold weather-related product didn't move as they expected, yet somehow tight inventory controls kept their overall inventory costs down, which it makes it sound like they were expecting low sales for their winter inventory to begin with. We wonder what would have happened had October been colder than usual rather than warmer than usual. Would they be short of product in that circumstance? Either way, we've talked in the past about how shoe retailers toe a fine line with inventory, especially with seasonality. And here, DSW was either lucky or good. And of course, the company will tell you that they were good. We kind of feel it might have been a 50-50 draw there. As for those hurricanes, when you look at the quotes, it seems as though they had negligible impact. Even the quote from their CEO, Roger Rollins, it went like this: "Much of our core business performed in line with expectations this quarter, despite an unusually strong hurricane season, which impacted comps and earnings." So he mentioned that they pretty much made their goals this quarter despite a hurricane season, but then they never go on at any point during the call to address specifically details regarding how much they impacted comps. And when we dug into the numbers and dug into exactly the number of shoe stores that DSW has in some of these hurricane-affected areas, you know, they have quite a few, but it's nowhere near the amount that would be impacted for certain other stores. And it's interesting that they use hurricanes in the earnings release as far as the reason why, or one of the reasons why, their sales weren't where they needed to be overall. Again, we think probably as much of it has to do with unseasonably warmer weather. If you want to blame weather, unseasonably warmer weather probably kept people from buying some of those winter shoes a little bit earlier on. If that part is true, though, we should see decent or positive comps for December and January. Either way, usually when they don't release, or a company doesn't release how much these things impacted comps, oftentimes you think that they might be actually scapegoating a particular facet. Successful companies like Home Depot and Walmart have been very transparent about the exact positive and negative impacts of the hurricanes. Lowe's, we saw in their earnings release, they were very transparent about it as well. And honestly, when you look at Rollins' quote from last quarter, or some of his quotes from the last quarter earnings release, you would think comps would have actually been positive regardless of hurricane impacts this quarter. In fact, he said that the retail consolidation in the shoe industry, and from here we're talking about bankruptcies and closures a la Payless, would help DSW gain market share along with their new initiatives that he said, and I quote, will inspire emotional loyalty with the DSW brand. Well, these new initiatives didn't pay off, at least in this quarter, as you saw negative comps. Now, some of that might have been due to hurricanes, but in all likelihood, their positive comps weren't going to take off in part because of these initiatives. These initiatives, which were officially released in September with a press release, came with the tagline, "Music for Your Feet." But so far, it hasn't been music for shareholders, as their shares are down a little bit after the earnings release, from $22.50 per share down to $19.20 per share. It's rebounded somewhat to around $20.33 per share now. Now, shoe retailers have seen their shares move up and down dramatically as footwear retailers either report positive or negative news. We've seen a little bit of both in the last 12 months. For the trailing 5 years, however, the company is trading down 41% overall. They have a $1.6 billion market cap and a price-to-earnings ratio of 19, which does indicate some growth, and I'm going to tell you where they might see some growth here with some of their strategic initiatives. I think some of the stronger parts of their strategic initiatives, including unwrapping their store as part of the omni-channel experience, accepting returns in the store, but also using stores to ship out merchandise, which is something that other shoe retailers have started to crack into. I think this will long-term benefit DSW, especially as it pertains to their e-commerce sales. And we don't want to be complete cynics about the company here. They are still very profitable. They're generating a very strong cash flow, and it's enabled a lot of growth in terms of their footprint. They're opening dozens of stores every year. They've opened 4 stores already in the fourth quarter, and they're very bullish on a Las Vegas store in particular, opening up on the Las Vegas Strip, that they feel like will be one of the more attractive stores in the chain. So there is something to like from DSW. I think we just sometimes get a little bit salty when things are scapegoated outside of the control of the business, when in reality, you're probably looking here at some of their creative initiatives not panning out like they suggested. But I do think in the future, you'll see e-commerce sales continue to increase for DSW. And I think the ease of return will probably create habitual consumption by those customers that find returns easy to generate. And this was something that we talked about Payless not really having or not really doing a ton of. One of the reasons why they were forced to declare bankruptcy is because their omni-channel presence just wasn't as substantial as it should have been.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we wrap up this version of the Retail Focus podcast with a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I tell you about a story that we're keeping our eye on for the next week or the next month. And we begin with Leighton.
My story has to do with social media, and this is a company we don't talk about often, if ever, on the Retail Focus. And this has to do with Snapchat, their $15 billion valuation. A lot have questioned over the past few months, saying whether or not they can actually monetize that platform. But companies are still trying to take advantage of their user base. And one way from a jewelry company that a lot of people may know, especially during the holiday season, is they run a slew of conventional ads. K Jewelers is trying to take advantage of Snapchat's platform and user base by having some different face-altering filters to really try to give the user a real-world look as to how some jewelry will look on them. So what it does is basically you put the camera in selfie mode and you're able to see different types of necklaces with different types of colors and how they would look on you in real life. And this is something that is obviously a virtual setup and something a lot of people have been talking about in terms of augmented reality and all the investments circulating around that, with Facebook, Google, all playing into that, trying to spend R&D dollars to really relate that to the future of retail. But as it stands now, it looks as though it's already here with some things like this. Some of these Snapchat filters will allow these users to get a real-world image of themselves, and then make those buying decisions. What's interesting here is that Kay Jewelers isn't looking to be spending that much money. So you talk about trying to monetize the Snapchat platform. How are they going to get money via ads? Well, companies are finding their way around those types of things. They're utilizing their social media accounts, whether it's Twitter, whether it's Instagram, Facebook, and they're actually getting customers without having to spend a lot per customer. So one of the big questions that's often asked to entrepreneurs on Shark Tank is, how much is it to acquire a new customer? Well, for a lot of these companies that are very industry savvy, they're actually able to acquire customers for very little, if not for free, on the whole basis. So I think this is a very interesting way to use a company and to use its customer base in a very smart way. And at the same time, you're bringing in sort of a view of customer loyalty, because you're able to do this with Kay Jewelers, whereas you may not be able to do that with their competitors. So they may look to this company first when trying on certain items, at least in the virtual setting.
That was something that was talked about a lot at shop.org, not only augmented reality, but tie-ins like this to social media, where customers can see what something looks like before they buy, but then also engage with others regarding that thing, because the bottom line is you might get some positive reinforcement that way and that additional push over the edge to purchase that thing. I'm going into a completely different industry for my looking ahead. I'm looking at the company At Home, the Plano, Texas company. Last quarter had comparable store sales positive 7.8%, and they'll release earnings next week. But here's the catch. Unlike some of the other businesses that we've talked about that kind of have talked about hurricane impacts, where they don't really have a ton of stores or a large percentage of their stores in that hurricane affected area, At Home Group has a ton of stores in the area that was affected by the hurricanes. And unlike other home improvement retailers, At Home is much more of an interior design type retailer, very similar to the Container Store versus someone like the Home Depot, who services building materials and also helps out contractors and that type of thing. So I wonder if the hurricanes had a significant impact at Home. Now, if it didn't, that tells me two things. One, At Home has excellent customer loyalty, and a lot of their comp store sales gains are organic indeed. And the second thing is, if At Home doesn't suffer, then realistically, you're not looking at a ton of other retailers that should, given the sheer amount of locations At Home has in the affected areas. The same thing could be said of the Container Store. They have a ton of stores as well in those same hurricane affected areas. So if those type of businesses aren't affected as much, again, it's going to be tougher to pawn off hurricanes as an excuse, and the market will begin to see through that. So that's what I'm kind of looking ahead to. Now, if the hurricanes do impact, well, then so be it for the At Home Group. But overall, this is a company that has been operationally extremely successful. And truth be told, they're in the running to make our list of the top five retailers of 2017. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. We'll be back next week with a fresh Food Focus. Tried a lot of different food this week. Excited to talk about it next week on the Food Focus. We'll also have Brett Bernstein as our guest on the Retail Focus podcast. He is the CEO and founder of Gatsby. He'll be talking about micro-influencers and how they relate to retail. So stick around for that. Again, we're on Spotify now, but you can find us and rate us via any podcast platform that's out there. So until next week, so long.
The Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.